Portland favorites Blue Cranes. Blue Cranes' newest album, Swim, shows the band turning yet another musical corner, expanding on their collective and individual strengths while forging into new experimental territory. The Creative Music Guild is an all-volunteer nonprofit promoting experimental and improvised music in Portland for decades. For more information, go to creativemusicguild.org. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Kneebody and Blue Cranes, live at the Alberta Street Pub, 1036 Northeast Alberta, Friday, November 8th. See you there.
KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theatre are proud to present The Yes Men Fix the World. Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO will be showing the 2009 indie classic film, The Yes Men Fix the World. The Yes Men Fix the World is the true story of two political activists posing as executives of giant corporations. In their thrift store suits, they lie their way into big business conferences and pull off pranks. That's The Yes Men Fix the World, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theatre, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/yesmen2013.
And good morning. This is Paul Rowland. This is Friday Morning Talk Radio. Ani and Lynn are on vacation. This is a generally positively revolting their show. Today I've got on the line Arne Gunderson, as you've heard, with over 30 years' experience in nuclear engineering and the nuclear industry. He was a licensed reactor generator. He was a former nuclear industry senior vice president. He managed and coordinated projects at 70 plants in the United States. So I assume he knows what he's talking about. And he's been one of the main experts in nuclear energy, speaking out about the situation at Fukushima Daiichi, which, as we know, 2.5 years ago was hit by an earthquake and a subsequent tsunami that crippled the plant and has led to the gravest nuclear reactor situation in the history of the world, I believe. Is that true, Arne?
Well, it's certainly the worst industrial accident in the history of the world, and it's right up there on a par with Chernobyl as far as the health consequences go. So it's bad, but thank you for having me.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for being on. I appreciate that. Where are we talking to you, by the way?
I'm in our offices of Fairwinds in Vermont, mm-hmm. Burlington, Vermont.
And tell us a little bit about Fairwinds before we get going here.
Okay. Yeah, Fairwinds is a, it actually was named after my wife's grandparents' blueberry farm, so it has nothing to do with wind power. But we started posting videos on the web right after the Fukushima Daiichi accident, and before that I had done expert reports, and they were kind of boring and not many people listened, but we went from 80 visits a day to 25,000 a day when I started putting our now famous videos up on the web. And we've become the go-to source on technical information. Huffington Post said we were the best website to find, you know, technical meat about the Fukushima Daiichi accident.
And so I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you know, I did mention some of, you know, a brief synopsis of your experience, but maybe you could tell a little more specifically what you were involved in, and then how you became dissatisfied, critical of the nuclear industry and, in fact, a whistleblower.
Yeah, you can sort of begin by saying I'm older than dirt, and we'll work back from there. I got out of school in 72 with a master's degree in nuclear and a reactor operator's license, and I was really gung-ho pro-nuclear and basically thought I was going to save the world. I worked my way up to become a senior vice president at a company that was licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And in 1990, I found out that my company was violating its license. So I told the president of the company, and he fired me. Then I went to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they knowingly and deliberately botched the inspection and said, no, there's nothing wrong there. So I got John Glenn involved, and my wife was a reporter, and it helps when you have you can put press pressure on politicians. But anyway, John Glenn held congressional hearings, and we were exonerated. All of the violations I found were confirmed, and the inspector general figured out that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was in bed with the licensee, didn't ever do a thorough analysis of my violations. And then on top of that, the Inspector General found out that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was taking bribes. So, you know, congressional hearings exonerated, but it still didn't prevent being blackballed from the nuclear industry. And we were sued for $1.5 million. It was really horrific. And ultimately, driven into bankruptcy and foreclosure, we lost our house and all that. So you begin again, you know. So Maggie and I started our career back up, and now we have Fairwinds, which is designed to tell truthfully what's going on in the nuclear industry.
That sounds like an extremely valuable public service, and particularly with what's going on at Fukushima, which there's really not widespread media attention, as opposed to the kind of media attention you could say is given to 100 other stories that seem to be of lesser import for global environment, health, and peace of mind, I would say. I mean, it's very disturbing. And then on the other side, there's the internet is prone towards having very strident and very extreme scenarios, apocalyptic scenarios, and it's hard to tell what is possible, what's not possible. So I hope we can sort of suss some of this stuff out over the next hour. And this is a call-in show. I would encourage very strongly people to try to really frame your questions well. We want to really keep this on track. There's a lot of stuff we want to cover, and we're not going to be able to cover nearly all of it this hour, but we'd like to at least get the main points that we went out. So when you call in, please try to keep it germane to what we're talking about and try to make your questions as understandable and pointed as possible. So with that, let's first talk about, obviously, the main reason that I called you up and that other people are calling you and what you're talking about mostly is the situation with the removal of the fuel rods in the cooling tower. Is that what it is, of Unit 4?
It's a spent fuel pool.
Spent fuel
which
pool.
Is 100 feet above the ground on Unit 4. And that seems to be what the world's attention is right now.
And so David Suzuki, a really respected scientist, came out with a statement that I'm not sure he intended to be released so widely. But I think it's been misunderstood. I think the main thing he said was the danger of a strong earthquake that could topple or further cripple that tower could lead to a truly catastrophic situation. I don't think there's anything to quibble with that statement, but I think it's been sort of taken out of context, and I'm not sure people really understand. So let's talk about what the possibilities, what the risks are with this operation, how they're going about it, and who is going about it.
Well, the risk of doing nothing is worse than the risk of removing the fuel rods. The building is compromised because of the earthquake and the explosion, and it's imperative to get the fuel out of the nuclear fuel pool. There's enough fuel in that, there's enough radioactivity in the fuel in that fuel pool to that's more than the amount that was in every bomb ever fired in above ground testing for 40 years. So there's an enormous amount of radioactivity in a very precarious place. So it's a lot of people are saying, why do we have to do this at all? The building is weakened structurally, and a significant earthquake, but not as bad as the one they already have experienced, could topple the building, in which case we could be in an apocalyptic position. So you got to empty the fuel pool. The problem is it's being done by Tokyo Electric, the company that hasn't gotten anything right in the last 2.5 years. The process will involve pulling these nuclear fuel pool, pulling from the nuclear fuel pool, nuclear fuel bundles. The bundle has about 80 to 100 rods in it, and the bundles will then get carried underwater because they're highly radioactive into a canister. The canister weighs 100 tons, so to be shielding. And then that canister will be taken out of the building, lowered very carefully, one hopes, down to the ground, and put in storage on the ground as opposed to 7 stories high, 100 feet high. That's how it should work. And if all goes well, that's how it will work. But, you know, frankly, I'd have a lot more confidence in the process if Tokyo Electric weren't the one doing it.
And so why is the Japanese government continuing to entrust these extremely difficult, complex, and risky operations to TEPCO?
Well, you know, I've been over there twice, and we wrote a book called Fukushima Daiichi, The Truth and the Future, but it's in Japanese only, so don't go out and buy it. So I've analyzed the Japanese response to this accident for 2 years now. And the response has been to protect the bureaucracy and to protect the nuclear industry before protecting the Japanese people. That's a typical response. We saw that at TMI, we saw that at Three Mile Island, we saw that at Chernobyl. And when I saw that developing at Fukushima, I turned to Maggie and I said, "No, I'm going to put my life on hold to prevent Fukushima Daiichi from being covered up like accidents in the past have been covered up." So the Japanese have an entrenched bureaucracy, and it's very hierarchical. So you're always trying to protect your boss, male dominated, and within the culture. We're seeing a huge schism. A lot of the women in Japan are rising up, likely for the first time, because they are worried about their kids and future generations. Whereas the men in Japan say, "Well, the president, the prime minister said this is what we have to do. Therefore, that's what we're going to do." So we're seeing a split. I'm not saying that every man feels that way, but. Significantly more women are anti-nuclear in Japan than men. But at the root of it, it boils down to money. The Japanese are trying to get 50 nuclear plants started up. And they had 54, and of course Fukushima Daiichi 1, 2, 3, and 4 are no longer with us. So now they're down to 50. They would like to start most of those quickly. And if they admit it to the Japanese people that this is a $500 billion cleanup, they're likely to get pushback from the Japanese public. I think pushback might be a moderate word. They're likely to enrage the Japanese public. So they'd rather not go in and assume responsibility. The Japanese government would not like to assume responsibility for this $500 billion cleanup. So it's easy for them to blame TEPCO. And as long as TEPCO is there, they've got somebody to blame. If they move in and say, "Okay, Tokyo Electric, you've proven yourselves to be incompetent. We're going to take over. We'll put in an engineering firm." Tokyo Electric's an operating company. They've never engineered anything in their life. So we'll put in a international engineering firm to do this right, and then move forward. The Japanese government assumed responsibility and financial responsibility as well. They don't want that to happen, but in fact, it's the best alternative to a really miserable situation.
What do you mean it's the best alternative? I didn't understand that last point.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, the Fukushima Daiichi's been allowed to get out of control. There were a group of us that said back in April of 2011, right after the accident, that there was not enough emphasis being placed on attacking this problem as if it were a war. You know, you really need it to aggressively attack the problem. And so it spiraled out of control, and you know, we're contaminating the Pacific Ocean now because the tanks are leaking and things like that. All of that was preventable, or at least the impact could have been dramatically reduced if Japan had taken it seriously 2.5 years ago. I was in contact with Japanese scientists back in 2011, the middle of 2011, and they were telling me that already Tokyo Electric was facing severe financial constraints. So we all knew what had to be done, but Tokyo Electric didn't have the money to do it. And the Japanese government was sitting on the sidelines blaming Tokyo Electric. So it was a situation that's allowed to get out of control. To get it back under control is going to take time. It's going to take years to prevent further water from entering the Pacific. And it's going to take 10 to 20, perhaps even 30 years before these plants are dismantled. But it can't be done in the present structure and done well. I think we'll constantly have problems like tank failures like we've had, you know, constant radiation releases as long as Tokyo Electric is in charge.
Well, I mean, if we look at, I didn't really think of this until the last minute, but so I wasn't able to really think of a serious list. But if we think of what has been paid attention to internationally and what we've spent energy on in trying to develop some sort of international consensus for in the last 2.5 years, I mean, we've got a possible intervention in Syria, which was only averted at the last possible minute. Iran's nuclear program, which, I mean, compared to what's going on at Fukushima, there just seems to be a perverse disconnect between, you know, the kind of international coordination that you and other people have called for, and that's necessary. We're not talking about, and we're talking about what's necessary for preventing possible catastrophic consequences here, and that we're doing politics and business as usual, which is generally not very healthy or helpful in any case. But now it seems to be a total denial. And I know that you are one of the signatories, you mentioned, of a letter to Ban Ki-moon, the head of the United Nations. Have there been any international conferences? Has there been any discussion at the United Nations about how to deal with this at all?
You know, the International Atomic Energy Agency has had its own closed-door conferences with executives in the nuclear industry. But, you know, those of us who are truly independent aren't invited into those meetings. So it's like the priesthood goes into the Vatican to decide who the next pope is. Then we have to sit around on the outside and wait till the smoke turns white. You know, and that's unfortunate because there's a lot of great information outside of the nuclear industry that's being excluded. The letter we wrote to 17 of us signed to Ban Ki-moon had three pages, and it's on the Fairwinds website if anybody wants to see it. But the first four or five were critical. Number one was, before you remove the fuel, remove Tokyo Electric. Number two is, Japan's got to step up and assume financial responsibility. Number three is, you need to bring in an international consulting company, and the precedent for that already exists. After Three Mile Island, the company that owned the plant realized it didn't have the expertise to clean it up, And they brought in Bechtel. Now, Bechtel is running the Hanford site out by you, and they may not be highly regarded in the West either, but they're a huge engineering company, it's going to take that kind of expertise. If not Bechtel, there are a half a dozen others that could do it.
But in an earlier conversation, you added another element, which was citizen oversight.
Yes, that's critical, and I think that's probably point number five. First off, was independent experts giving advice and having that advice received. Prime Minister Abe just said that he's anxiously awaiting international advice, but I'm still getting calls saying the Japanese are refusing that advice when it comes. But the key is a transparent process being overseen by civilians. There are, academic experts outside of the nuclear industry in Japan and in the United States, and I'd volunteer and things like that, who could shine the light on this process to make sure that the health and safety of the public is put first, and the profits of Tokyo Electric are put a lot further down on the totem pole. So I think those are the five key pieces. And it holds together only with a transparent process overseen by civilians. I was afraid that if you replace Tokyo Electric with, let's use Bechtel as a name, but there are others, then the Japanese government will have somebody else to blame, and especially if they don't provide adequate funds. So an independent organization of citizens can chime in and say, we need more money, and the nation of Japan, and hopefully some world organizations as well, but the nation of Japan is on the hook. We've got to clean this problem up before the contamination spreads even further.
But we do have a caller, which we'll go to in a second. But so you do see that it is possible. I mean, I'm projecting on other people, but I feel like people are feeling really disempowered and kind of impotent in the face of this. And sort of there's an unwillingness to think about it because it's so complex, so big, so scary. So you do feel that it is possible to limit further damage, and barring another major earthquake before, the critical next stage of dealing with these fuel rods gets finished, that that we can actually contain the damage.
Well, the key is, there's a lot of apocalyptic things out on the internet now about moving the fuel, but the real apocalyptic thing would be an earthquake, not just for Unit 4, which is structurally damaged, but Unit 3 had a detonation inside it, a severe explosion, and is actually structurally a lot worse than Unit 4. So, we've got to move forward quickly on Unit 3 as well. And frankly, Unit 4 will be a walk in the park compared to the problems encountered on Unit 3. But there are solutions if there's the money and the right attitude to solve it. And I don't see that that happening right now.
Okay, well, let's go to our first caller. Sue, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, in light of TIBCO's kind of ineptness in all this, I'm concerned about a release and nuclear fallout in the Northwest. Is there anything that we can take to try and protect ourselves against that fallout? I mean, if you take more iron, things like that, I don't really know.
Okay, that's a great question. When the accident happened in 2011, you could have taken an iodine pill, potassium iodide called KI, and that would have prevented one of the isotopes, radioactive iodine, from entering your thyroid. The problem, and I advise Americans not to take the pill, because the iodine concentrations were relatively low, and the pill does have side effects. But the Japanese didn't get the pill either, and that was truly frightening. They had the pills pre-positioned, but because the local governments didn't get word from the national government, they didn't issue the pills for about a week. So now, what should Americans do now? I've had some people say, well, maybe I should take zeolite pills, and you can do that. But the problem is zeolite is very good at removing cesium from your body. But it also removes other good nutrients. And radioactive cesium potentially could be released from the Fukushima Daiichi in the future. If they screw up and break something, there likely will be a cesium release. But I warn people, if you're going to take zeolite pills, do it with a doctor, because you're stripping your body not just of the radioactive cesium, but some of the good nutrients you need to maintain a healthy body. Other supplements are, you know, the more positive supplements you have in your body, the more natural supplements you have in your body, the less likely then a rogue element will displace that. The one thing that did happen in the Pacific Northwest from essentially in March and April of 2011 were hot particles were wafted across, essentially from Portland on the south up to Vancouver on the north. There was significant hot particles deposited locally. We had one of the scientists we work with had air filters, continuous air monitors, they're called, set up in Seattle. And we could clearly show that the average person in Seattle was ingesting about 10 hot particles a day into their lungs. And no matter what you do, you can't get that out. The particle size was such that once you breathed it in, it lodged in your lung. So it's not a matter of taking appropriate supplements in the event something like this happens. What people in Seattle could have done would have put air masks on, but of course by the time we got that data and analyzed it, it was May and the worst of the cloud had already passed. The authorities did know about it, though. I'm absolutely convinced that authorities did know about it and chose to keep us all in the dark. There was a case up in Seattle where the government announced that it was going to be flying helicopters up and down the coast, all the way through the Seattle area, and they said they were doing background radiation monitors, and it was just purely coincidence that they were doing it 90 days after Fukushima Daiichi. I don't believe that. I think that those helicopters were looking for hot particles, and we were not told the outcome of those helicopter surveys. They said it was a national security secret. So authorities did know and didn't warn us in time, and people like Marco Caltofen, who actually did these studies, told the American Public Health Association. But it was already essentially too late to take precautions.
Well, what else is new? I mean, the same thing happened with Chernobyl. I was here at the time. Same thing happened with Three Mile Island. It seems to be standard operating procedure. Well, thank you for calling, Sue. We do have a couple other callers. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio coming at you from Southeast Portland. My name's Paul, and this is a Friday morning talk radio. I'm speaking with Arnie Gunderson, who's a longtime nuclear expert. He'd worked in the nuclear industry at fairly high levels for many years and became a whistleblower when he told his boss that his company was violating their contract and suffered economically and elsewise, which is not uncommon for whistleblowers. And we could also talk about what's happening with NRC whistleblowers. But first, let's go to this next caller. Harvey, go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Paul. Thank you very much for the show. And Arnie, you're a modern-day hero to me. You know, I guess the most popular kitchen accessory in Japan now is a Geiger counter.
Mm.
And if you go to Google and you put in the word keychain Geiger counters, all these Geiger counters come up. so you can use them going over your food and water. But, you know, here in California, there's supposed to be the radioactive plume from the ocean is supposed to arrive in 2014. That's just when they're going to open up the Carlsbad desalination plant. And I wrote a letter to Dr. Helen Caldicott saying, does radioactive material get through a desal plant, the membrane there? And she said, yes, they cannot stop the radioactive material from coming through. It's so small, the little plutonium emitters and so on and so forth. So I feel that we're going to be, people who are drinking desal water are going to be drinking radioactive water. So I think that they should close the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant right here. It's sitting on the Diablo Cove fault line, Runder reactor number one, and that connects with the Shoreline fault line, which connects the Huzgari fault line, which is part of the San Andreas system. The whole thing is set up to tumble. We're always told that the big one is coming. And meanwhile, they're fracking in Monterey, and the USGS and the Army told us that fracking triggers earthquakes. We're going to have our own Fukushima right here if we don't take action right away. So I want to thank you, Arnie, for keeping us all knowing about what's happening, because it's life and death out there. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Harvey.
You know, let me talk about this, the personal radiation detectors they're using in Japan and people used in the States as well. But it's especially acute in Japan. There's a false sense of security that comes from those. They're handheld and about waist high, and you look at a gauge and it tells you how many the millisieverts or microsieverts you're getting. But what it's not detecting are the hot particles, are the airborne dust that you're breathing in. We had there's a great example up on our website of we asked for air filters from people in Japan, and we found air filters in cars from Fukushima Prefecture were loaded with radiation. So people were driving those cars, obviously, and that means that their lungs are loaded with these same hot particles. But hot particles aren't picked up by a handheld radiation detector. It's the handheld radiation detectors they're using in Japan are just what's coming off the ground. But as a car drives by and kicks that dust up, and as the kids are playing on the side of the road, they're breathing it in. So my concern is that all of these surveys being done by citizens, while nice and while important, are effectively masking the problem of airborne contamination. Or a kid walks through a pile of leaves and gets radiation on his shoes, and then unties his shoelaces, and the hands go in the mouth. All of that is not factored into the dose calculations that we're seeing coming out of Japan. Now, moving on to your other question about Diablo, I absolutely agree. Diablo is an extraordinary risk because the seismic risk there was grossly underestimated from the get-out. I was involved on San Onofre, a little further south, and there the seismic risks were significant, but nowhere near as significant as they are at Diablo. I would agree that I'd love to see Diablo shut down because it poses an enormous risk. You know, it's a world of low probability, high consequence events when you deal with nuclear. And I've said that a nuclear plant like Diablo can have 40 great years and then just one bad day. And we don't remember the 40 good years. We remember the one bad day because it becomes one bad year and one bad, decade and one bad century. So we're dealing with a technology that can turn on you in an instant. And we're also dealing with human hubris here. We think we built Diablo to withstand the strongest earthquake imaginable. But I think Fukushima Daiichi showed us that we designed these plants economically. But if Mother Nature throws us something that we hadn't anticipated, they can fail. And, Diablo is, like you said, sitting on half a dozen different fault lines and is risky. Now, a little to your north of Portland, you also have the Columbia plant out on the Hanford Reservation. And Columbia's under-designed structurally as well. So it's a problem endemic to the concept of nuclear power. We build them to be cheap.
So Harvey did also ask about this, the radioactive water that's coming our way. And I understand radioactivity has been found off of or in Alaska. And are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry, I just went blank there. But we do have another caller. If you could put that on hold, the idea of what sort of radioactivity have we been getting, what the radioactivity in the marine populations in the Pacific. But we do have another caller. Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, very interesting show here. And the question I have is, when they shut down Trojan nuclear plant that is close to Portland, they removed a lot of the radiation things that sent it to Hanford, but they left the spent fuel casks there, and they're lined up in the open, an eighth of a mile from the Columbia River, and they every once in a while you'll see someone coming with a hazmat suit checking for radiation. And I'm wondering how come they didn't send those to Hanford, and are we in danger from them?
Yeah, the storage of spent nuclear fuel is a problem that's not going to go away quickly, I'll tell you. At Fukushima Daiichi, the fuel was stored in these fuel pools and is extraordinarily dangerous because it's actively cooled. There's pumps and things like that. At Trojan, the fuel got cool enough to be air-cooled, and was moved into these casks. They're called dry cask storage. Well, Daiichi had dry casks too, and they withstood the tsunami and the earthquake just fine compared to the building. So they're certainly not risk-free. Don't misunderstand me, but getting the fuel into dry casks is less risky than keeping the fuel in the fuel pool. But the real question is, what are we going to do with it for a quarter of a million years? You know, these dry casks are licensed for about 40 years and tested to withstand 40 years of the rigors and the elements. But as a nation, we have no policy to take care of that waste essentially in perpetuity. There's a really good movie out. It's called Into Eternity that talks about and apolitically too. It's not neither pro nor nuclear, pro nor anti-nuclear. It's called Into Eternity, and it talks about the moral issues of: do we really have the right to burden generations upon generations in the future? You know, because we want to watch Dancing with the Stars tomorrow night. So, your question on is the fuel safe in those canisters? It's safer than in a fuel pool, but it needs to be stored in some kind of geologic storage place. Two other problems, of course, become: how do you warn future generations that it's there? You know, we can barely read Shakespeare and can hardly read Beowulf, and that's 500-600-year-old English. So how do you warn people 1,000 years from now in a language that we may not even understand? And the other part of that question is equally frightening. Should you warn people that it's there? Because if an Adolf Hitler or a Joseph Stalin comes along and wants that material, he's going to know exactly where to dig in the future. So it's a generational burden that you know, as a nation, we have to face. Now, a lot of people will say, well, one thing we can all do is stop making more. And I would agree with that.
So I just want to apologize to my listeners that perhaps due to my inexperience in talk radio, I did not actually give the number. So the people who called already knew that the number to call in to be on the radio with this with Arne Gunnarsson this morning is 503-231-8187. And I know we only have about 15, 20 minutes left. So again, my apologies for that. If for anyone who did want to call and I did not give the number, I'm sorry for that. But I do appreciate the callers. And again,
Paul, Your caller right before that talked about the contamination in the Pacific.
Yes.
While we're waiting for callers, I could answer that.
Yes, we do have a caller online, but please do answer that because we do want to hear about that.
Okay. I went out and I bought some Alaskan salmon and sent it to the lab about 2 months ago, and it is still squeaky clean. So, but, you know, salmon go out to sea for years, and then they come home. So I am continually checking seafood from the Pacific because these top of the seafood animals will concentrate cesium and strontium. And what I would advise, especially at a state level, is to push your state to measure it and to push your state to put those numbers out there. You know, I don't want to hear a state expert say, well, it's below standards. I want to know what that number is so I can make an informed decision as a consumer. And right now we're not doing that. Nationally, we're not doing that either. And you know, you have a very active senator on nuclear issues, you know, Senator Wyden, and I would hope that if there's one person in Congress who really cares passionately about solving the Fukushima problem, it's Senator Wyden.
And we do have a caller. Billy, go ahead. You're on the air with Arne Gunderson.
Thank you so much. Speaking of food, since we're all kind of poverty-stricken at this point, many of us, I find myself eating quite a bit of tuna, and I'm just wondering how long I can continue to eat canned tuna before it's no longer advisable. And the next question, two questions, second question, please. Where in the United States, if you could speak a little bit about where in the United States, because of, you know, geographical, you know, mountain ranges, river valleys, et cetera, one could move going east to be somewhat safe for a while, at least from what's happening in Fukushima, as a, not, you know, in relation to what's happening with the plants here in the U.S.
Let me ask this, answer the second half of that first, because I think it's really important. We had there's an epidemiologist named Dr. Steve Wing, and back in 2011 we had him on the Fairwind site. And he talked about exactly your question. Basically, you know, should we run from the Pacific Northwest? And if we did, where would you go to? And the example he used is you can probably move to an area where the radiation is lower, but that doesn't mean that the net risk that you encounter is lower. You know, I had somebody say, well, they had left Oregon and moved to Louisiana. Then, yes, Louisiana didn't get anywhere near the amount of Fukushima radiation that that Oregon got. But Louisiana is the cancer capital of the world because of all the chemical plants and petrochemical deposits down there. So they ran from one risk, radiation, into a more significant risk, of chemical pollutants. There's a movie out called The Atomic States of America, and the woman who it focuses on lived in a town in Long Island that was very near to Brookhaven National Laboratories. They had a reactor leak, and a lot of people died, and it was hidden by the government, and ultimately this woman and others documented it, and people were compensated, but you know, when you're dead, compensation doesn't help very much. But at the end of the movie, it talks about her journey to find a place that's safe. And she found a county, a beautiful, pristine county. I won't tell you where. And it was pristine. And her last comment on the movie is, but you never know what's coming down the driveway. Well, after the movie was made, they started fracking next door. So, again, this issue of do I run from a Fukushima risk into another risk is a lot more complicated than we can talk about on the radio.
Well, you know, I mean, when you mentioned fracking, you mentioned Louisiana petrochemical. So, basically, what we're talking about is this insatiable need in modern industrial society for these potent, highly concentrated forms of energy that all have serious consequences. And we're not addressing that in any kind of systematic or serious way, whether it's nuclear, whether it's fracking, whether it's oil, whether it's tar sands. And that's a bigger issue for another day, but it seems intractable, just like Fukushima seems intractable, but it's because there's no sense there. We've been depoliticized. Our ability to organize ourselves has been undermined, and the people who have taken on the responsibility of organizing everything for us are playing these insane games and are not dealing, do not have a sense of priority when urgent situations arise like Fukushima. Well, that's my little editorial content.
There was another question there about tuna.
Yes.
And I know of no published tuna studies, and again, that gets into the fact that we've got to push the national government and state governments to not just to go out and survey the tuna, but tell us the numbers. And it's just not available. And there's always the Atlantic Ocean if you want to buy your fish from a source that has less radiation in it than the Pacific.
Okay, we do have another caller, Miriam. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for both of you doing this discussion. It's so timely and needed. I'm from No Nukes Northwest here in Portland, and from a new group that we just started called Radcast. And Tom Hartman's putting out our Radcast, which is it's a censoring program of good meters, a good understanding of what's going on in our air. And what we do is we put that out so that people understand when they look outside and they see nothing but sunshine, there is something else going on out there, depending on perhaps where the jet stream is and what's coming down from Fukushima, what the latest, steam out, I have my own terms for this, over in Fukushima has happened. And it's so important, and I'm so happy to hear so many people listening to this show today and to you, Arnie, with your information. One of the things that we do is we supply our area with information regarding radiation, and KBOO, in fact, on their news show in the afternoon, posts our radcast. And I encourage people to ask us questions about that so that the citizens can know what are the good Geiger counters to get. Arnie, you mentioned the ones in Japan. Yeah, they're lesser models for sure. And the intermediate models are so much better, and they're not that expensive to get. So I just really appreciate what you're doing. And if people want to get in touch with us at radcast.org, we're working on that today to let you get in touch with us so we can keep you informed. And Arnie, we're going to have you on our website as well, just information from your site. And really, I'm just calling to say thank you for putting out true information about Fukushima.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I was not aware of Radcast, and it's important for citizens to realize that they can do good science. Science doesn't have to be left to scientists. The example that I'm very familiar with is a group called SafeCast, and they're over in Japan. And it was citizen scientists with Geiger counters and a GPS system on bicycles driving around Japan, and every 100 meters stopping, getting a reading, uploading it to... They've got 3 million... 3 million samples now of background radiation throughout Japan, and the scientific community is realizing just what an enormous resource these citizen scientists had done. And I hope that Radcast does the same thing. This data collection doesn't have to be left to scientists. It can and should be something that the public should participate in.
Well, since Miriam gave her organization's website, radcast.org, as it sounds, there's also your website. Want to give that?
Sure, thank you. Yeah, it's Fairwinds, Fairwinds, fairwinds.org. And we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and if anyone wants to donate so we can continue into 2014, we'd love it.
And I had Harvey Wasserman on for just a short period, about 15 minutes at the end of the news last Thursday, and he's at nonukes.org. I just wanted to, before we get to our next call or two, we're rapidly coming down to the top of the hour and the end of this program. I'm speaking with Arnie Gunderson from Vermont, who's a nuclear expert, and he's trying to tell us about of Fukushima, what the real risks and perils are, and what is being done and what might be done if there was really some sanity in this world. I guess I'd put it that way. But I just want to ask you about Harvey Wasserman's initiative, this what he calls a global takeover. Maybe in Japan that might not go over so well, since there is this whole issue of pride, and as we have in this country too, and the whole national security, all these things that you were talking about earlier. But there does need to be some sort of international financing, because it's a very extremely costly thing, and international assistance to this, which is not happening. He has a petition drive going, and you can find out about that at nonukes.org. And he's got, you know, he's excited that he has like 120,000, 130,000 signatures, but I mean, and that's great. But I mean, there's been, I've seen petitions for issues. Every issue is important, don't get me wrong, but this seems to be of a particular gravity, and it seems like there should be way more signatures on such a petition. I'm not sure if some of these major organizations that do petition drives have taken this up, and if not, why not? These are all questions that could be gone into. But what do you think about this petition initiative, which is kind of parallel to your letter to Ban Ki-moon?
Yeah, Harvey and I have spoken extensively. And just last night, we put up a new petition that basically says, before you remove fuel, remove TEPCO. And it's up on moveon.org. Harvey's got 150,000 signatures and delivered it to the UN, I believe, yesterday. And you're right, it's similar, not exactly the same, but similar to the letter that the 17 scientists wrote to Ban Ki-moon. And largely, they parallel each other pretty darn well. And I was impressed that Harvey could get 150,000 people to sign on to a problem that's not in their country. You know, this is the Americans have said, well, it's a Japanese problem. In fact, it's the Pacific coast of the United States that's really understanding that this is a global problem. You know, here in Vermont, it's a back burner issue. So, you know, my congratulations to, you know, Senator Wyden and the citizens on the West Coast that are really realizing that the problems at Fukushima don't stop at the edge of the Pacific Ocean in Japan. They've, in fact, crossed the Pacific Ocean to America. And, you know, it could happen. The other lesson from Fukushima is that we are contaminating the Pacific Ocean, and that's a big body of water. What if this happened on the Mississippi? What if it happened on the Missouri River? What if it happened on the Great Lakes? We would destroy the water supply for 40 million people. And so if there's good news about Fukushima is that the border of the plant is an enormous body of water which dilutes down the concentration. I don't want to minimize the impact of that radiation, because while the concentration dropped, there's, you know, billions of people that rely on that water for fishing and for drinking and for, you know, recreation and stuff like that. So that we've contaminated a body of water with what scientists in the nuclear industry would say is too low to worry about. But when you take a source that's dilute and you multiply it by the billions of people that that in fact use that source, you know, you can expect enormous numbers of cancers as a result anyway.
So we do have a couple more callers. Jack, go ahead, and you're on the air.
Right. I'm sorry I dialed in late to the program. So if you addressed this earlier, that's my apologies. But I'll try to make my question short. And since you're an expert with a lot of long background studying this, what I'm curious about is this. There have been almost 3,000 nuclear test shots around the world since 1946, or even earlier, actually. 44 maybe is when they did the Trinity. But and great number of those are atmospheric shots, lots of them in the Pacific. And, you know, one example, of course, the biggest accident of all, the Castle Bravo shot. I'm sure you're very aware of it, the one that contaminated the Marshall Islands. due to a miscalculation, they thought it was going to go off at about 6.5 megatons, and it went off at 15 due to a miscalculation with the lithium-7 isotope. That was huge contamination. How do these contamination that we the legacy of contamination from the Pacific Proving Ground, how does that compare to Fukushima?
Thank you for that question.
Yeah, that, I'll just take the answer off the air.
Yeah, that's a great question, and we hadn't talked about it. The amount of radiation that went into the Pacific from largely French tests, but also American tests, is smaller than what is going into the Pacific now from Fukushima Daiichi. You know, the concentration in the Pacific from essentially cesium-137, we had contaminated the Pacific back from all of the above-ground testing, 700 bombs above ground and a couple thousand below ground. But so we contaminated the Pacific with cesium-137 anyway. But Fukushima Daiichi's plume that's heading toward the west coast of the United States is about 10 times more radiation in that wave as it comes toward the United States than what we had already done from bomb testing. So we've further contaminated the Pacific much more so than the bomb testing in the Pacific back in the 40s and 50s.
Okay, we're going to have to start wrapping up. If we get a chance to get the last caller, but before we do that, I'd just like to get you to, this is kind of too big a question, but I mean, there is talk of apocalyptic scenarios, which we can't discount, and maybe perhaps not talk about that, but talk about where you see this going. I mean, where Harvey Wasserman called for you know, scientists and engineers and governments to really take this seriously. Where is the world scientific community? Where are the scientific associations, the bodies? Are they making statements on this? Are they, you know, where are your colleagues? There's 17 people signed this letter, but is there a discussion that's starting to percolate, or is it just sort of a few people, the same few people over and over again?
Well, I think that the scientific community has been largely silent. And largely doing it in closed doors. There's a nuclear priesthood out there, and they really are trying to control this information so that the public doesn't have a seat at the table. We're seeing Japanese doctors not being able to tell their patients that the illnesses they're experiencing are radiation induced. We're seeing Japanese scientists not being able to do good research because they're afraid that they'll lose their grants or lose their positions in universities. So there's a lot of pressure to minimize the consequences of this. You know, on the opposite side of this, though, is that one would think that whether you're pro-nuclear or anti-nuclear, solving Fukushima Daiichi's problems are to everybody's advantage. This is not helping build new nuclear plants when people realize that we're contaminating the Pacific.
So are there nuclear industry and corporations that are offering to their expertise to this?
Well, the answer is no. You know, they're trying to pass a law in Japan to exempt American companies from being liable if any of their things fail and cause people to get even sicker. But American companies are not moving in until they've got their liabilities limited. So we're actually pushing the Japanese to limit the liability of American companies before American companies want to step up to the table and help out. You know, unfortunately, I think the lawyers are running this cleanup as opposed to the engineers and the scientists.
It's an old story. Well, yeah. We're definitely going to have to wrap this up in the next 30 seconds. Any last words?
No, thank you very much, and you know, thank you to the people in the Pacific, on the Pacific Coast, because you're really the conscience of America on radiation-related problems right now. And just keep the heat up on Congress, please.
Okay, well, this has been Friday Morning Talk Radio. My name's Paul Rowland. I've been speaking with Arne Gundersen, a longtime nuclear expert, works with Fair Winds, and that's www.fairwinds.org. I believe I have that link already on this on the page for this show. Thank you very much for listening. And coming up is an interview that Kathleen Stevenson has done. I'll let her talk about it. We're going off the air. Thanks a lot for listening. Stay tuned to KBOO for the rest of the programs.
Co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm, on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:01 a.m. Coming up, Kathleen Stevenson speaks with Portlanders Tammy Dean and Hossein Rojantalab, who recently returned from 7 months traveling in Iran, Hossein's country of origin. At 10 here, Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, a confirmation of the poisoning of Yasser Arafat, but by who? At 11 on The Digital Divide, host Rabia Yemin interviews author and editor-in-chief of The Economist website called Tom Standage. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still help us make up that $9,237 deficit by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.